Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kessner.
And this is Claire Kaplan. As we always do, we want to let our listeners know that sometimes we have discussions on this podcast that can be difficult to process in here. So we want to make sure that you take care of yourselves while you're listening, whether it's to reach out to family or friends, or maybe speak to a counselor if you have one, or even call a hotline. Additional resources can be found on the Take Back the Night Foundation website, and I'll give you that address at the end of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Claire. And today, our very special guest, Melissa Lombardo. Melissa does a million incredible things for survivors and supporting and healing and survivorship. She is going to talk all about all of those things, but we always start, Melissa, with a little bit of your own bio in your own words, the way you like to share, like where did you grow up, hobbies, interests, school, whatever you'd like to share about yourself personally.
Yes, thank you very, very much for having me. My name is Melissa Lombardo, and I am originally from Connecticut. I think growing up, my life was characterized by Girl Scouts. Prior to that, Brownies. I was very involved with softball, and I always loved reading and writing. I actually, when I think I was about 10 years old, I published my first book for a school project, and I used my last name as the per se publishing company. I found it a little while back, and I just had a chuckle of looking at my 8-year-old illustrations and my text and things like that. So I've always had a love for reading, writing, playing sports, getting out in nature. And we had 2 cats growing up. And I love, you know, spending time with the cats as well, just, you know, with their curiosity that they had in life.
That sounds already very interesting, Melissa. Did you grew up in Connecticut and you went to high school there? Was it a co-ed school or a public school?
Yep, it was a public school. It was Glastonbury High School. My mother was originally from a city. My father was from a small town that was very big into farming at the time. And for them, the town that I grew up in was kind of the middle ground between a city and a country. And so I got to grow up in a beautiful town. It's called Glastonbury. It's still there. My parents still live there. Great town. Yeah, I had a great experience growing up with different friends. I think one of the memories I remember the most was a trip to Washington, D.C. when I was in 7th grade and got to go on bus to Washington. I just remember, you know, being mesmerized by the Washington Monument. And I don't remember even what park it was, but there was this park. It was a sculpture park, perhaps. And there was this big hand, and we all took our photos in and around, you know, this huge sculpture, I think, of a hand. So I had really good memories growing up. I still have a lot of friends that I keep in touch with from my childhood as well, which have been wonderful support systems for me over the years. And we still keep in touch, and they have been with me, you know, through all these endeavors in life.
And so will we then maybe talk about where did your survivorship come from? What happened in your life?
So as you know, for a lot of people, you know, when you finish high school, a lot of students think about college or technical school or, you know, work after graduation of high school. And in my case, I had the opportunity to attend a local state college. It was a great experience. And during that period of time, unfortunately, you know, I did face sexual assault. That being said, I do not hold my university accountable for any of that. I had a really good college experience, you know, outside of that. But I was in my 21 years old during that period of time, you know, when I was assaulted at university, off campus.
And who was the perpetrator?
Perpetrator was someone that I was an acquaintance with. You know, we had studied similar path, and the person was older than I was, so we didn't have the same classes all the time. I was taking a summer class, and that particular person had taken the same class I took, but at a different time period prior. And at the time, I had thought, oh, okay, summer class. That person was also taking a summer class, had offered to help me study for one of the exams for that said class. And I said, okay. And unfortunately, it was a study group where I did start feeling uncomfortable, and I asked the person to leave, and the person did not have any intentions of leaving. And I had did lots of things to, you know, to keep me safe. And unfortunately, none of those things worked, I guess, in the end. And that person did not.
What do you mean by you had lots of things to keep you safe? That was an interesting statement. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. I mean, for many years, I've never been one to just me personally. I've always been a conservative dresser. And I've always been very space aware of, I'm not going to get into somebody else's car that I don't know very well, or go to an area of town, for example, that I'm not familiar with. So at that time, at my, my 20 years, I was a sophomore in college. I said, this particular person had said, we can study at my place, I'll pick you up and get dinner after. And I thought to myself, no, that's not a really good idea. So I said, well, no, instead of that, how about we meet at the place where I was living at the time, no dinner involved and things like that. Because I knew that area, I knew where I was living, I knew the building, and I was making a choice, not to have dinner afterwards and, to give any mixed signals and things like that. So that, that I had thought in my mind at the time, I said that was keeping me safe, from anything that could have happened to me. But as, we know with sexual assault and sexual violence, that, sometimes, most of the time, no matter, what someone does or not, someone still might take advantage of another human being. In, in this case, the 20-year-old Melissa, not doing something that, is conducive to healthy.
So you were really, you were strategizing pretty thoroughly, it sounds like. And as you said,
I've always been a thinker. Yes, I have always been a thinker.
Right. Yeah, I was saying that so many people discover that strategizing safety is sometimes, as you learned, based on what people tell us we're supposed to do. But it isn't actually that the people who perpetrate have other ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually when I was in the environment that I had, I felt safe in, which is, the place that I lived, it got to a point where, we were studying and, everything was going fine. And I specifically at one point in time, I remember thinking that something's not right. Like there was definitely a change. There was something that was not right. And I said to said individual, I said, okay, I think you need to go. It's time for you to go. And I said that knowing that something just seemed a little bit off. And that person wasn't going to go until they got what they wanted. So at any rate, then, me trying to, like you said, strategize and, be safe and do all the things that I thought, would keep me safe, in the end, it didn't go that way for me.
Right. The rude awakening after all the messages we get.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like Melissa, one thing we talk a lot about on the show is, do we blame ourselves? I'm wondering, because I'm listening as you've rattled off all these incredible protective measures that you've had in place. How did you come to say, like, despite all that, it's not my fault?
Oh, that took me a long time, because after it happened, I blocked it. I block very well. And I think I blamed myself for a long time, because I even remember afterwards, I had this thought. I used to walk in the park, and, at the time that, I was being safe, I was wearing a pair of gym shorts that went down to my knees, and I was wearing a large baggy type of just white t-shirt, with some type of print on it, and I remember afterwards, the thought that crossed through my mind was, I didn't even look that good. I wasn't even wearing anything nice. I wasn't even wearing makeup. My hair didn't even look that nice. Like nothing about me looked great. I think for a long time, I tried to think about what could I have done differently. And in a sense, I look at, looking at it now, that was me continuing to blame myself of, I could have done something else. I could have done something else. What could I have done? I know now that nothing I could have done would have made that difference, I guess, except for saying no to the study group. But, I really wanted to get good grades. And I just thought it was a really good idea to, study and things like that. So I think I blamed myself for a very long time. I was also threatened and I was very scared. And I felt, I think part of that blame, it came that shame of what just happened. I don't think I even was able to believe it myself of what just happened. And, in the beginning, I don't even think, I know I couldn't even put the word and a sexual assault or rape to what happened to me. It was just that in and of itself was too much for me to think. And so it was easier at the time to disassociate and to not even think it happened. And actually, while it was happening, and I've said this to, you know, to a few people before, that I wasn't there. My physical body was there, but the rest of me wasn't there. I was somewhere else. I know exactly, you know, where I was at the time, you know. So I think for a long time, it didn't have, you know, it didn't happen, because then I had to face what that, you know, what that meant for me. You know, I had to face that pain even more that I already felt.
Well, that's such a great description.
Yes, I know. This is so helpful. Melissa, thank you. You're so clear. And I think our listeners are really going to learn so much. So when you started to say, like, it kicked in and said, this happened. What were some of the things you were thinking at that time? Like, did you want to tell anyone? Were you too embarrassed? Like, how did that unfold in your world?
I was definitely scared. And I knew the type of work that the individual that assaulted me did. And that in and of itself kind of went hand in hand with, let's see, with who might believe me or not believe me. And this was somebody who was working in systems that dealt with incarcerated people. And that was part, you know, part of my fear was, you know, who's going to believe me? So my sexual assault actually went unreported. And it wasn't for months, you know, and I could tell that there was changes in me. I wasn't sleeping and things like that. And I remember that, you know, as I kind of came to grips that something happened to me, I went to a friend. And, you know, in any sexual assault or in any trauma, actually, you know, just the support system is just so crucial. And I went to a friend of mine who is still a friend to this day. And just, I knew, you know, that I was just ready to break. Something was, you know, wrong. And I told my friend what happened and didn't explain it, you know, in words that were concrete at the time, but I explained what had happened. And, you know, at the end of telling him, he looks at me and he says, Melissa, what you're telling me is that you've been raped. And that was the first time I heard that word. And it was just so strong and powerful for me, you know, just to hear that that word was associated with me and something happened to me. And I think I would say, I'm not exaggerating when I say I probably cried for about 6 hours. I didn't leave my friend's apartment for about 6 hours. And I cried on and off, and because I just couldn't assimilate it. Even, you know, even then, you know, it was hard. And luckily, my friend had, he's very compassionate, and he wanted me to get continued services, said, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to do that. So he really bring me to places like the sexual assault crisis services so I could get counseling. And he brought me to the doctors and various things like that, just, you know, just to see what would be the right fit. Because, you know, after something happens to someone, you know, not every single doctor or counselor is going to be the right fit for them. So he brought me to 3 or 4 different places to see, you know, what would work. And so I did find the fit with somebody from the, you know, sexual assault crisis services in New Britain, Connecticut. It's actually the YWCA SACS program. And that's where I became a sexual assault advocate many years later.
Oh, wow. That's perfect. Well, what happened in between?
In between, there was a lot of what I call running away. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
That describes it well.
In between, I had great friends. So I started seeing this wonderful counselor. You know, we can't find out who she was. It was such a long time ago, but I really would have loved to know her name. So I guess part of me, whenever I go on podcasts, I think it's, you know, if there's any sexual assault, you know, crisis advocates listening, and if any of them worked ever, you know, New Britain YWCA many years ago, you know, it might have been her. And I'm just thankful for people, you know, like her and like you all who, you know, do this work, you know, on a daily basis. And I started to see her. She encouraged me to write, and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote in journals. And, it, you know, I saw years later, I looked back, and it was just a way to help process. I mean, I wrote some really awful things, and, you know, I wrote some things that later on could translate into that I finally started seeing a little bit of hope. I ended up taking on a job as in Miracor Vista, and I went to New Mexico. I was able to travel around the world, and I was able to attend graduate school. And while I was in graduate school, I had a work study, and that work study led me to start working on activities for Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April. And I did that, and I asked my mother to give all of my journals to a friend of mine to bring me up to school in Vermont. And I started putting together the draft of the manuscript that would later become the book I published. We performed the performance piece, you know, section of it with student and faculty colleagues. And it went over really well. And then 2 weeks later, I got on a plane and I moved myself to Nicaragua for a school internship. And I thought I was healed. I thought everything was fine. And, you know, and I think in the end, it took almost 17 years of living abroad to come back to the United States and be faced with, you know, so many old memories and feelings and thoughts and realize I got to keep healing. I never really healed. I just thought I healed, or I put the label on saying, you know, after I, you know, went to counseling for these particular sessions and after I wrote this manuscript for, you know, helped with activities for sexual assault awareness one, that I was healed. It was a part of healing. It was a step into the next direction, but was it really healing? For me, it wasn't. And it took until me coming back stateside after living abroad so long to realize, you know, just how much I needed to heal and just how much I had really stuffed down inside me. You know, this happened when I was in my 20s and I'm now in my 40s. So there was a lot of, you know, those things that, you know, kind of happened upon reentry to the United States that made me realize that I'm going to have to, you know, start healing, really healing, because I had some health problems. I was getting flashbacks again and triggers and things like that upon, you know, reentry to the United States. So I ended up joining a writer's group and I ended up applying a few different times to become a sexual assault crisis advocate. But it was, I say a few different times because it took me 3 times just to be able to get through the course, because the first time I just couldn't go through with it. Just asking for the application was difficult to do because I knew what it would entail. I knew what it would potentially bring up if I had taken that, you know, those classes.
But can I ask a question? Like when you know, I want to learn a little bit more about that experience for you. You knew, you anticipated what it might bring up, but can you describe that in a little more detail? Like, were you worried about flashbacks? Were you worried about triggers? Were you worried about your ability to go back in that moment or go forward to helping other people? Like, tell me more about what you were concerned about at the time.
So the two significant things that helped me with the healing process were two of the most difficult things, one being the writer's group, which I'm still involved with to this day, and the other being the crisis advocacy certification in the state of Connecticut. So on the writer's group part, that entailed me taking out that, you know, manuscript, reworking it and making it my own. And that meant that part of the worry was the triggers, because I know that manuscript so well because it's me. Those are my journal entries from when I was 20 years old, 21 years old and things like that. So I knew that it was going to bring up things because just looking at the manuscript caused me a reaction. It caused me to break out in a cold sweat. It caused me, you know, a headache looking at it. So that part, I knew it was necessary, that I needed to be able to get to the point where I could read that, where I could speak that. At that point in time, when this was only a few years ago, I still could not say out loud that I had been assaulted or that I had been raped. That was still difficult for me to do just up until a few years ago. And then on the second part of that, which would be the certification course as an advocate, and part of it was, you know, just putting myself out there and being more vocal about the things that I know and how to help others with the things that I know also happened to me and how to balance that. Because what still sometimes will happen to me is movies and television, and there's talk or scenes or something that's related to either sexual assault or dating violence or, you know, or sexual violence, anything like that. And that does still trigger me into thinking about some of those other things that have happened to me or happened to people I know. Because as I get more into this work, I hear stories about others. And I knew that the sexual assault certification course to be an advocate wasn't going to be any different. I was going to be hearing facts and figures and stories and learning more about childhood sexual abuse or domestic violence and things like that, and grooming, you know, all the things that have to do with what advocates do. And I wasn't sure how that was going to affect me. And there were moments in the class that I was affected, because they were just these realizations of putting oneself into the rest of the world. And I knew it wasn't just me, and I knew it wasn't just, you know, he, her, she, or whoever. I knew it, you know, I know it happens to a lot of people. And it wasn't until the advocacy course that it kind of re-brought home just how many people this happens to. So in a sense, I wanted to keep going to be able to help as many people as possible. But at the same time, it was very difficult because I had to remind myself to take that break, to take that breath. And there was a couple times in the class where I did need to leave the class, walk outside, you know, into the hallway, just get some fresh air. And there was always another advocate who would be there to support those of us who might have needed to, you know, process a little bit more. So I knew that there was going to be a lot of things coming up. But at the same time, I was ready to be able to kind of take that and say, you know, this is part of what I know I need to do to heal. For me, that, you know, that was right. So I went through the advocacy training course, and this is my, this would be my third, I'm going to my third year as a sexual assault crisis advocate in the state of Connecticut.
Wow. We could go back to your book and the journal. And then how what was your writing process? So, you know, did you write every day? Did you set a certain time and space and place, you know, just to dedicate to the experience? Like, how did that go?
There was a whole long process. I think it took a few years, but I know it was something that I needed to do in my own organic time. And in part, it began when I joined the writing group. And at that point, I was very clear that I wanted to do something more with my experience to be able to support healing in others. I started thinking about my own support system, family and friends, and I thought to myself, you know, there's been so many people that have been there for me, whether they knew or not something happened to me. And I wanted to be able to support healing for others, however that might have meant. But I knew I needed to also heal. So I started getting these books out of the library, different authors that also wrote about the same topic. And I'd have them in my room, and I had them covered in the beginning because it was still too difficult for me to even look at titles at the time. But I knew that I needed to start taking back control of the experience that I didn't have control over. So, you know, as time went on, I started to rework and rewrite in certain sense of the manuscript. I started to research a little bit more. I guess I started more journaling a little bit more, but I started researching a little bit more about updated facts and figures. I ended up in the end also becoming a member of the Take Back the Night Foundation, and because that was very significant to me, the work that they've done. And I had went to an event of theirs, you know, years prior, soon after the experience.
Wait. You're so fast. Can you describe the Take Back the Night event that you went to?
It was on the college campus, and this was after I had disclosed to my friend that I had, you know, something had happened to me. And there was a Take Back the Night event on the college campus, and I did go to that. And for me, what I was able to do at the time was be in the audience and listen to others who were sharing stories and walk in the same, there was some type of rally. It must have been something, I don't know, it was a nighttime vigil with candles or something. I don't recall exactly, but I was able to walk with the group, you know, as they shouted out things. I couldn't shout out anything at the time, but they were able to, and I was walking with them. So I do. And then years later, when I performed the activities for Sexual Assault Awareness Month at graduate school, we were able to do a t-shirt project, or I think it was called the Clothesline Project. We were able to do that. In addition to, we didn't do anything Take Back the Night related, but we were able to incorporate some of the activities that I had seen on campus from that particular Take Back the Night experience.
Amazing. I'm so happy you described that, Melissa. And I think I find really fabulous that you said, you kind of opened the doors to a lot of our listeners to know you don't have to be on the stage. You don't have to speak at a Take Back the Night. You don't have to even, you know, state your survivorship. You can just be there and listen and join in this community of support that's just, you know, right there for you. Does that sound kind of what your experience was like?
Yes, because I truly believe that healing isn't linear. And, you know, everyone is where they're at the moment they're supposed to be at, you know, and it might not be that time for them to get up and speak or for them to do more than they're doing. I remember in graduate school, when I was working on the activities, And we had asked for people to give stories, you know, if they wanted them to be read at the final event. And a few people gave stories, and they were anonymous stories. And to this day, I don't know who they were. And there was others who didn't give stories. And one of the most significant ones was somebody that came up to me, and she never outright said something had happened to her, but she came up to me and she said, thank you. It's going to make me cry. She said something to the effect of, you know, thank you for what you're doing for us. And then she basically just turned and walked away. And like, you knew it took a lot for her. Excuse me, Aunt Terry. It took her a lot to say that. And I was just, you know, I just knew, you know, that was just one of her ways. She participated. She did what she was able to do by saying thank you, even if she couldn't do anything else, because that's where she was at, you know. And I just, it was an amazing moment for me. And I think you're completely, go to a Take Back the Night event, you know, or any event where they're speaking about the topic or a rally, there's so many different roles you can play if you're able to go there. I had somebody recently at my book inauguration, which was also amazing. And the person came up, I recognized a lot of people at my book inauguration, which was just this past May. And this one particular person came up for me when I was signing books and said to me that they weren't sure if they were able to come to my event, and they weren't sure what it was going to be like, but they read the press release that was, you know, published in the local newspaper, and reading the press release made them think that maybe I was different, that this was going to be an event for them. And they said to me that they'd never been able to come to an event such as this that talked about this topic, because they were a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And the person that was standing in front of me was probably about 50 or so years old. And I stood up and I told them, I said, I'm honored that you were here, you know, and thank you very much. And, you know, I was very respectful. And I said, you know, is it okay if I give you a hug? It was a very quick, you know, very pat with my two hands, you know, but they said yes, and that was okay. And they walked away. And my first thought was, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And because you never know, like, that person was able to come to this event after however many years after their experience, and they were able to come. And it was just, they were able to do what they were able to do, just like that, you know, person on the college campus that had come up to me, you know, to say thank you. And sometimes I don't, you know, why do I keep doing this? Because it's that hard, and I have to reflect, and, you know, I have to take my alone time after that, because it's just, sometimes it's really difficult hearing stories. But then it's when people come up to me, or when something happens that remind me why I keep going. So those type of stories are some of those reasons that it reminds me of, this is why I keep speaking out, because, you know, if there's one person that might benefit from one thing I said, or, you know, three words in the book, then I would have done my job as a human to help, you know, someone else on their own path of healing. And, you know, we don't know how many people or who we're going to touch when, but it happens, you know, just like your podcast. I mean, these are moments that, you know, are producing effects with so many other people that you won't ever know, but it'll happen. And I think that's just what kind of keeps me going. And, you know, when I deplore in life, I said, you know, why do I keep doing this? Because it's so hard. And then just something happens that reminds me of that purpose.
I think you bring up a really important issue, and you've said it in different ways. I think it's really important for the listeners to know. People want to get involved and do some of this advocacy work. They always want to help other people. How and when and in what manner really matters for each person. You know, it's like, you have to be ready for it. And it's not a failing on anyone's part if, for example, it took three times to be able to get into that advocacy class, you know, that things happen when you're ready. And when I was on the end of being the person to interview potential applicants for a hotline and screen them to see if they would be ready to do it. And we often would say, after meeting with someone, I'll say, she might be ready in a year, but she's not ready now. And I didn't want those people to feel like they've rejected me. You know, I think that it's not a rejection. It's really, we want to make sure that you can manage it, you know, and because when it doesn't work out, it harms everybody, you know. So I think it's really wonderful that you have taken your steps to do things when you are ready to do them.
Thank you.
Melissa, I have another question that I think would be helpful, since you're so clear. I think what's so interesting in talking to you, you know, our listeners listen to so many different voices, And I like the journey you've taken us on is like, I took all these preventative measures. But the other thing I think that's so interesting too is in Connecticut, where you were, it clearly, I think you're in your 40s right now. And when this happened to you, it was 21, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So think about like 20-ish years ago in Connecticut, what I find fascinating is likely there seemed to be accessible resources. There was still, you know, you having to go through the normal healing and breaking through that initial shock phase of trauma, but you were surrounded with options and even your friend was the one who said, this is rape. And that's an important part of our historic like journey as a country to think about what's accessible 20 years ago and what's accessible now, including you, Melissa. Like, you're also a resource 20 mm-hmm. years later.
That's right.
Doing this work with your book, with advocacy, with survivorship. And I think we could, you know, delve. I just wanted to acknowledge that historic kind of perspective of your journey, Melissa, because I think it helps. You know, some of our listeners are 16. Some of our listeners are 86. And I think it's always different for each person. Some are in North Dakota. Some are in Florida. You know, some are global. So I like to give our listeners some perspective on that part of your narrative. And it sounds like we didn't talk about this. I don't know if you had siblings, but it sounds like you had supportive parents. Would that be accurate or not so accurate?
Oh, yes. My mother, who probably is going to be listening to this podcast as she does every other interview and she reads every single print that's put out about me, she has been one of my biggest supporters. She was very involved with helping with the book inauguration event. My brother actually was my editor. He was an English major and he's a teacher and he was the editor of my book. My sister is an actress. She performed in California in various movies and in commercials. And her and I actually just finished recording the audiobook version. It won't come out for a while, but since it is a book performance piece and a journal component, and we wanted the performance piece to come alive. And we actually recorded it. And that was the first time that I was able to read most of that book out loud in front of my sister while it being recorded. So that was a really big part of healing. What I've realized is that publishing this book and taking these steps to get to publishing and beyond has been synonymous with healing. So for me, publishing and forming my own imprint, which is called Write, Heal, Thrive, was a way that I didn't realize until later or recently. It was a way to take back control of that narrative that I had lost. So, you know, when we're sexually assaulted, we don't have choice. We don't have control. Something's being done against our will. And by publishing, I was taking back control. It was being able to say the word out loud, rape. It was being able to say I was sexually assaulted, you know, and it's being able to say that I'm not going to let this hold me back any longer. And publishing about it and being in a room for book inauguration that your mother is helping you plan and with family and friends. And my godfather was there and my father's cousins were there and various, you know, close friends of the family that were my parents' close friends, you know, my parents' close friends, they're all there listening to me. And I, you know, if I thought about it too much, I probably would have not shown up at my own book launch because I thought, wow, I'm hearing all these really personal things that I never even talk about to a room full of people that have known me since I was born or people that I went to high school with or college with. It was such an amazing intersection of, you know, of people. So, you know, the support was just so important. And I think community is just so important. And you touched upon resources. And one of the things that just came to my mind, you know, some people, you know, might not think that they have resources, but they do. Somebody like the two of you, Claire and Katie, who do this type of podcast, or somebody like me, even though, you know, I might be out in internet land or in, you know, in social media, that there's somebody out there that, you know, believes you, that cares for you, that knows you can get through these hard things. I think just knowing that for any of your listeners, I just think it's so important because I think that's what helped me get through, just knowing that there's been voices that have come before me or, you know, people like you, Katie, that have done all this groundwork so that someone like me can years later speak as well or talk about things as well, you know, and be able to be inspired by those people that came before me. So I think that that part is so important, you know, and then obviously, of course, having family and friends and things like that that have been with me, that have encouraged me to go into publishing, you know, to help me live that, you know, the best life that I was kind of running away from, which I was enriched by all the traveling I did. I was enriched by all those experiences in between, but it wasn't until that journey words to myself that I was really able to really kind of, I don't know, open myself up for all those additional possibilities, you know, that are still on their way that I don't even know what they are yet.
So we're going to have to wind up, but I want to, can you talk a little bit more about your book, about what, it's a memoir, yes? Am I right?
Yeah, it's called Hurt, Healing, and Hope, Thriving Beyond Sexual Assault. It is a book, performance piece, and journal. So it can be something that somebody could read to themselves. They can read it out loud, or they can purchase licensing rights that get donated to crisis area crisis centers, and they can perform it in a community theater setting as well. And so after I became a sexual assault crisis advocate with the New Britain YWCA Sexual Assault Crisis Services, I asked them if they would write the foreword for the book. So they wrote the foreword, and a portion of all proceeds of this edition goes to the Crisis Service Center to help survivors, whether it be a doctor's appointment or a taxi or an Uber, you know, or clothing that they might need. So I'm donating a portion of proceeds from the book to them, and then also a portions of licensing rights to anyone who wants to license this to be able to perform it at their, you know, school or college campus or what have you, also will go to them. If somebody can read it out loud, they can also read it to themselves. They can also perform it. And then at the end of the book, there are study guide questions for further reflection. There is a section for performance notes. And there's also a journal section where a reader or a performer can also journal their own hurt, healing, and hope. And they can think, well, where would my hurt fit in with Melissa's performance or healing or hope? And everything about the book is very significant. A friend of mine from college actually did the layout and the cover design. His name is Nikita, very talented lettering artist. And I also just published a guided journal, and it's called Right Healing, Right Heal, Thrive, a transformative journal experience. And it's just a way for people to continue healing and to continue journaling if that's something that works for them, and help, you know, just help them also thrive in their own lives. And for the second journal, for the second publication, I talk a little bit about the importance of journaling and the importance of art and creativity also as part of healing. Also has original illustrations by my husband as well, who I met in Nicaragua and I was living abroad many years ago. So they're two complementary publications just to continue supporting the healing of others who are going through hard things, you know, such as sexual assault or other, you know, other traumas as well. I've realized in this journey that, you know, there's so many different types of trauma. And then also there are things that might come about, such as substance abuse, because of other underlying trauma. So I've been really moving in the direction of just supporting people who are going through, you know, the trauma of sexual violence, but knowing that there might be other things going on with them as well, you know, because one plays into the other, because, you know, part of trauma is, you know, there sometimes are domino effects of, you know, something else might arise from it, you know, just because of the hurt, the immense hurt that someone feels.
That's wonderful. It sounds like a great book and a wonderful resource.
Agree. I don't have any more questions, Melissa. This was just fabulous. You were so helpful. I think you provide not only your narrative, your story, your vulnerability, but also, you know, you now are a creator of resources and support and more ways to find advocacy and more ways to sit with people wherever they are in that healing process. So I am so grateful that we got to talk with you on the podcast. So, and I'm also grateful that you found Take By The Night. We love being a source of support and connectivity for survivors in a, you know, except for COVID, always pretty much in a real oxygenated space. Oxygenated. Whatever that is. But yes, like a you know, a living, breathing experience. So Melissa, you help so many. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, if anyone is interested in learning more, they can just go, I guess, to my website, rightheelthrive.com or melissablombardo.com, and they can learn a little bit more about me and how to find me, how to connect with me. I'm on all forms of social media, and let's see where I go in the next year. I'm really looking forward to working on a few different trainings for writing and art in conjunction with my husband as part of healing and using some of these same resources to help others, you know, get into journaling and in art as a form of reflection.
Wonderful.
I love it.
Right.
I love it. Claire, I think you can close us out.
Yes. Well, thank you again, Melissa, for joining us. And thank you, of course, to our wonderful group of volunteers who make this podcast possible. And thank you, listeners, for being here and bearing witness. Help us help other survivors. Please subscribe to the podcast and share it on your own social media and follow us on our Facebook page and Instagram page. If you need support but don't know where to find it, if you go to takebackthenight.org, you'll find a list of resources and also how to reach our legal support hotline. And remember always that self-care is essential to healing and thriving.
Thanks so much, Claire. And again, thank you, Melissa, for joining us. And for all of our listeners, continue to thrive, survive, take one day at a time. It's not as in Melissa's own words, healing is not linear. I love that you said that, Melissa. Thank you. Access any resources. We are all here for you. We can't be there always in person like we can be at Take Back the Night, but we absolutely appreciate your listenership and your support. So together we will shatter the silence and end the violence. Take care.